This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices, sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, Robin Coleman for Peace, Love and Pets speaks to Isabel Gulo from Care for Paws and Katie Bean from Creekside about their efforts to make pet boarding more affordable.
We just looked at the resources we could provide, creating a big safety net in the community to keep these pets healthy and in their homes.
Also, KCBX's Father Ian Dellinger traveled to Paso Robles this past November to attend the Garagiste Festival. This year's starts next week in Solvang.
People that come here, they really take their time to kind of taste through and understand the owners and the winemakers and the people behind the table.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, January 27th, 2025. I'm Meher Ali. Let's start with poetry. We invited Caleb Nichols, the new Poet Laureate of San Luis Obispo County, to talk with Lee Herrick, the Poet Laureate of California, in a Poet Laureate to Poet Laureate conversation.
We are recording this interview on Friday, January 24th. And Lee is here today in San Luis Obispo to read at the inaugural Poet Laureate reading at the Octagon Barn, along with me, outgoing Poet Laureate Kevin Clark, and Poet M.T. Vallarta. Lee is also leading a poetry workshop at the Nipomo Library on February 1st, organized by Coastal Dunes California Writers Club. Welcome, Lee.
Thanks for having me, Caleb.
My pleasure. So my first question is, I think what a lot of listeners want to know is, what really is a Poet Laureate?
Well, that's a good question. And before I speak to that, I just wanted to congratulate you. I think you have an exciting couple of years ahead. You know, a poet laureate is a person, a poet who is appointed or selected to represent an area and advocate for poetry in that area. It can be a town or city. Mm-hmm. I believe most states have a poet laureate.
Yeah.
As you probably know, many countries have a poet laureate. And so, you know, I hear words like ambassador or representative, but really I think we're just trying to elevate, advocate, and educate where we can and just bring poetry to as many people and communities as we can.
So it's really about public service, I think, for you. And I think for me, too, that lines up with my understanding.
Yeah. It feels that way, yeah. You know, I watched on YouTube your formal appointment by the supervisors. So it does have that civic official feel to it, but I see it very much as a position of service.
Yeah.
I'll be curious to see what your 2 years are like. Sometimes it's things that you might have been doing already, because I know you've been very active in the community. My guess is that there might be some new things where you're speaking or you are giving a workshop or a reading in a community that's not typically used to poetry, but it's exciting.
Thanks. That's key what you've said about communities that aren't typically exposed to poetry being a really important part of the role. So what brought you to poetry, and then what was your journey like to becoming the Poet Laureate of California, which is a huge state?
I've started thinking just in the last year or so about that question, what was my first exposure or what brought me to poetry? And I've started thinking that when I was in Korea, where I was born, before I was adopted and came to the United States, someone must have sung to me. Mm. Someone must have hummed or maybe read something. Mm. I don't know if it might have been my birth or first mother or a social worker.
But I read your poem about that, and I just really loved it.
Oh, thank you, Caleb. Yeah. I guess another way to say it is, you know, I read some really interesting, sort of mysterious poems in school. Mm-hmm. But the thing that really brought me to poetry first was music. I know you're a accomplished musician. I can't play an instrument to save my life, but I love live music.
Yeah.
And I loved in the mid-80s when I was in high school. You know, I was listening to a lot of punk and sort of classic rock at that time, like Hendrix and Zeppelin. And a high school classmate of mine gave me a mixtape of Run DMC. Yeah, right? So I had never heard this before. And then I started listening to A Tribe Called Quest and these rap groups that were doing very inventive things with the lyric. And I would pore over those lyrics.
Yeah.
And I would look at what they were doing with the rhyme and the imagination.
Yeah.
And that got me going much more seriously than into poetry, where then I began to study poetry as a craft.
I mean, this is so similar to my own journey. It all starts with music for me.
Yeah.
Same way, paying attention to lyric. And, you know, a big question I always get is, what's the difference between a song and a poem?
Right.
And I do not have an answer for anyone. But
really?
Not well. I mean, I could. Like, we could talk for a long time about that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But it seems a lot of poets, I think, start with music. I think that image of you mentioned of there must have been someone humming to me.
Yeah.
In early childhood is so beautiful, but also really resonates with me as well, because it's that early introduction to just music. In our house, there was always music.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, whether it was the Beach Boys or, like, I had a very punk rock aunt in the 80s who listened to a lot of Bauhaus. So that was in my early childhood brain.
Yeah.
But it does bring you to that, I don't know, it imbues you with this sense of cadence and rhythm and melody and lyric.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just beautiful, whether it's a band or a singer or group. But, you know, even just the music or the sounds of the natural world, I think, can be pretty impactful for someone that's writing.
Yeah.
I started to study it a little bit more seriously in college. And then, you know, to the second part of your question, a quick sort of synopsis would be that I just kept writing.
What did you study in your undergrad?
In my undergrad, I studied American literature.
Okay.
And I was focusing on Black novelists.
Cool.
So I was reading Toni Morrison, Alice Walker, Ralph Ellison, people like that. I didn't actually get an MFA. Mm. So my master's degree is in English with the focus on classical rhetoric. So I studied, basically I was studying Aristotelian theory, some of the Greek philosophers and rhetoricians. But poetry, I just devoured, and I studied in a few workshops and just read voraciously and started writing. Then in 2015, I served as Fresno Poet Laureate. And, you know, I don't think any poet, at least not one that I know of, ever really aspires or thinks I want to do that someday. At least it was never really on my radar. But I accepted a nomination. And as you say, it's a huge state, so I didn't think much of it, right?
Yeah. And Fresno, though, is a really big city.
It's a big city, and it's a great poetry city.
Yeah, the Fresno Poets.
Right.
That's a famous school.
Oh, it's a great, great city for poets.
I got a book from outgoing poet laureate Kevin Clark about that school of poets.
Oh, that's great.
On my shelf.
I love that lineage of laureates passing on books.
So you were the Fresno Poet Laureate for 2 years.
Yes.
And then how did you get nominated for the California Poet Laureate?
So the Fresno Arts Council nominated me.
Yeah.
And
so you must have done a good job.
I mean, I hope, you know. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, we do what we can. Mm. And you're going to do wonderful things. In my experience, and I've asked other city laureates this, it's hard to do everything you want.
Sure.
You know, we have so many ideas, and you've done so much, and this is in part, I'm sure, why you're in this position. But for me, you know, I was able to do some really neat things in Fresno. So they nominated me, and then it was quite a wait. It almost fell off my radar because, you know, there are so many great poets doing great work in the state. And then at some point, maybe 6 or 7 months later, and I interviewed with probably about 6 people from the governor's office.
Wow.
And then it was made official. It was very exciting.
I mean, it's such a big deal, I think, to me, to other poets, to be representing the whole state. And you seem to make the rounds quite a lot. Like, you do a lot of events, and you have this event coming up next month as well.
You know, it's hard to do everything we're asked, and I can't do everything all the time. But going back to something you said earlier about this being a position of service, public service, if a grade school asks me to come visit their 4th graders, I want to try to be there. I was asked by a state prison. I want to try to be there. So there are Yeah, it's been quite a bit of travel.
Yeah.
The first year, I did something like 120 events. It was a lot of time on the road. Mm-hmm. But what I loved about the Fresno laureateship is discovering those new places and being available and bringing poetry to small libraries and things like that that are really invigorating for me. I do my best to be present for each one and try to learn and enjoy as much as I can when I'm there.
You know, it makes me think, for me sometimes, as a creative person, I do a lot of what I think of as business. You know, there's a lot of administrative work, but also there's the creative stuff that we do. And I wonder how those things interact for you. How has that balance been for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's almost always on our minds, right?
Yes.
And now you're in this new position, more visible perhaps, or more requested in different ways. I went into the nomination, even before I was appointed for the state, determined that I would continue to write. I didn't know that I would, but I was determined. And so one way that manifested itself was if I was in Southern California somewhere, a literary festival, for example, normally I wouldn't do the activities if I'm one of the speakers. Yeah. But I found myself writing whenever I could in new places at new times, maybe just because that was the time that I had to do it. So I've been writing, which feels good. And as far as the business side, I'll try to block out a time when I just do that. I do have an assistant who's incredibly helpful. Mm. He does some of the work.
It doesn't sound like it's necessarily helped your creativity on its own, but it's changed your creative process.
That's a good way to put it. I have thought about that until you just said it like that.
Right.
But and that is maybe good.
If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas, and I'm Caleb Nichols talking to Lee Herrick about his role as the Poet Laureate of California. I think that's interesting because, like, I just finished a PhD, and the first year of that I was working and doing that and researching a lot, just reading a lot. I was writing as much as I always do. But the second year I had this gift, really, which was I got to just be there doing it and nothing else. And so I wrote so much poetry.
Wow.
I mean, my only job that year really was writing poetry or for like 9 months of the year. And it was incredible. It was incredible. Like just to have the time. I don't know if I'll ever have something like that again. And then the following year was the writing up year, as they call it in the UK. And like I was just writing, not poetry. For me, it's been a little bit hard to like continue creating as I feel like I'm just in that headspace of administrative work and like writing grants and like those kinds of things. So I love that. It's almost like a little tip because I think maybe it's going to be important for me as well to think about carving out time and doing it a little bit differently.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I never try to tell someone what to do, but if that's helpful,
it is.
I've found that it's been good for me, but also necessary because ultimately, we are poets, and I think a position of service can take a person a bit out of what they originally were or still are. In other words, we can lose sight of that, I think. I want to remain a poet as I'm doing the laureateship as well.
But you know, what's interesting about this to me as well is so much of being a writer in like the public conception of what that might mean is the myth of the lone genius toiling in a dark room somewhere, which is partly true sometimes. You know, you do have to work alone. Mm. But then also there's the other side of writing, which is we're writing with others and we're writing in response to others. And the Poet Laureate is so public and it's the service role and you're meeting so many people. And I think that's interesting. It's got to affect your writing.
Definitely. You know, I wasn't sure how many occasional poems I would be asked to write.
Mm, that's interesting, actually.
Yeah.
Have you been doing many of those? Yeah.
I've done a few. To your point, there have been a lot more social events and things like that. But one that was fairly recent was through the Department of Energy group of scientists supercomputing out of Berkeley.
Wow.
And it was their 50th anniversary, and they asked me to write a poem commemorating their 50th anniversary, which is not my typical audience, or right. I'm usually not writing about supercomputing and things like that.
Did you write the poem?
I did, and it was a challenge.
Yeah.
Have you done one?
So I think an occasional poem is, here is an occasion, I'm going to write a poem for this, right? The only occasional poem I've written is for my anniversary. I try to write one.
Oh, that's nice.
I've written two of those now. Not every year, but so I've been married for 11 years.
Uh-huh.
Actually, just this last weekend was our anniversary.
Oh, happy anniversary.
Our ninth anniversary, which is 2 years ago, I wrote a ninth anniversary poem, which is
very
an odd
nice.
Year. Then I didn't write a 10th anniversary poem.
Uh-huh.
But then I wrote another one this year. So I think I'm on odd anniversaries. That's my thing. No one's ever asked me to write a poem for the dedication of this park or something. Uh-huh. But I think it would be fun to try. But I think the thing about supercomputing, like writing a poem for that, is so interesting. It reminds me of – do you know the band Deerhoof?
I know of them.
So they're like an indie rock band, we'll call it.
Uh-huh.
And they're pretty noisy and strange.
Uh-huh.
I once saw them at Linnaeus Cafe in San Luis Obispo in the 90s before they were a big band. It was incredible. Uh-huh. Anyway, they did a show at the Super Hadron Collider. And then you can find it on YouTube. And it just made me think of this,
yeah.
The way arts can interact with science. And
oh, yeah.
I think that's so fascinating and cool.
I love it. And by the way, happy anniversary.
Thank you.
I love those intersections, or when we think things or ideas or people or cultures or aesthetics or genres are so disparate. I love when they merge.
Yes.
And I love the strangeness that comes out of that. It's not always easy and clean, but it was interesting to hear people come up to me afterwards and what they said about the poem. Or, you know, there have been bands. I can think of a few bands that have incorporated science very lightly,
yeah.
At the very least into a video. I don't know why my mind just went to Beastie Boys Intergalactic.
Hey, but... yeah, that's a good one. That's a great one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I actually have a line from a Beastie Boys from that song in a poem that I'm not going to read tonight, actually.
Oh.
It's a little too...
What is the lyric? Can you say the lyric?
Well, it's just the refrain of Intergalactic Planetary, but I changed one of the words and I can't actually say it on the air.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll have to go find the poem.
Yeah, it's called Life on Mars. You can find it online.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Which is a great Tracy K. Smith book.
Yeah.
So a lot of poets have written about this, musicians.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to think about poets in space, I think, because we'll be there. We are there. And, you know, as humanity seems to inevitably be reaching out beyond the planet, it's interesting to think of, like, who's going to be the first poet laureate of the moon?
Right.
Well, Mars.
I think Ada sent a poem on some kind of vehicle into space. There was a poem that she wrote. You know, maybe we're biased.
Is Ada Limón now the first poet laureate of space? That's a good question.
She would be a great one.
She would be great. California's proud.
Oh, I'm incredibly proud of her. She's incredible. But, you know, we're biased as poets. But I do think as the robots or the machines, which in some cases are necessary, but when they start to overreach and engulf, I do think it's artists who will keep us together.
Yes, I agree with that. I think that is, as these things keep changing and building, there's a role. It's almost like we learned in the pandemic, right? Like, artists are really important.
Yeah.
Maybe we didn't learn how to compensate artists during the pandemic, but I think a lot of people did have a reckoning with, oh, we really need the arts to survive.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think bearing that in mind, we should hear a poem if you have one.
Sure.
Now, it doesn't have to be about the Large Hadron Collider.
I thought that I would read a poem. It's a short poem. I wrote this in 2016, but I'll read this with Altadena, Pasadena, the folks who have been impacted by the fires in Southern California. So this is titled, How Smoke Clears. Because rain is liquid grace, the mother cloud in midday light. Limit the bad fuel. Care for your slow breathing, whatever shape it takes. Aramid, buffer zone, cold front. Know the escape route. Pack your faith. Farewell the burn. Sing to the clear blue sky in your magic beating heart.
Wow, that's really beautiful. And kind of brought us back to earth, I think.
Yeah.
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 Well, I wonder if there's anything we haven't touched on that you'd like to talk about.
I could mention a couple of things. One is that my statewide project is called Our California. And I've invited any Californian, any age, any background, any level of poetry writing experience, documented or not documented, to write a poem about their town.
Lovely.
Or their California. And we're publishing all of those at the California Arts Council website. So if any listeners are interested, you could find that online. It's called Our California at the California Arts Council. I'm excited to be reading with you tonight.
Oh, right.
And I wish you the best in your term.
On that note, you can follow slowbookbike.com, which is my pop-up bookshop that also does readings, and then I do a monthly newsletter. So if you go to slowbookbike.com, you can be connected and hear about all the readings happening in Slow County.
That was Lee Herrick, Poet Laureate of California, in conversation with Caleb Nichols, the new Poet Laureate of San Luis Obispo County. Lee was in San Luis Obispo this past Friday to read at the inaugural Poet Laureate reading, along with Caleb. On February 1st, Lee will lead a poetry workshop at the Nipomo Library, organized by Coastal Dunes California Writers Club. This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Up next, Peace, Love, and Pets.
I'm Robin with Woods Humane Society. This is Peace, Love, and Pets. My guest today is Isabel Gulo, Executive Director and Co-Founder of Care for Paws, and Katie Bean, new owners of Creekside Pet Boarding in Arroyo Grande. So welcome, ladies, to Peace, Love, and Pets.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Awesome. I'm going to start with you, Isabel. So tell people a little bit more about Care for Paws, how it got started, how long you've been a part of it, and kind of where that idea came from.
So we got started in 2009, and I was then a shelter volunteer for many years prior to that. And we got together, a group of us at the shelter, because there were so many animals. We were caring for about 120 dogs in a kennel or a shelter made for 40. And it was just heartbreaking. And so we started talking about different programs that we could offer or should offer in the community so that people can keep their pets. We looked at free spay neuters, assistance with vet care, assistance with pet food, education for kids. So we started a youth program called Paws Up for Pets. We have grown so much since then, but that was kind of the base. We started offering dog training classes because so many animals, as you know, are given up because of behavioral problems in the home. And so overall, we just looked at the resources we could provide, creating a big safety net in the community to keep these pets healthy and in their homes.
Much needed. I love that safety net philosophy. So give us a rundown of some of those programs. And I know the clinics are what most people know you Care for Paws for.
Yeah, we have several different programs. And the largest one, as you mentioned, is our mobile clinic program. We helped, just in 2024 alone, over 19,000 dogs and cats with anything from spaying and neutering, vaccines, flea treatment, nail trims, mass removals, dentals, you name it. We can do a lot of things in our two units. They travel up and down the coast from Carpinteria to Slow City is the furthest we've gone in Slow County, but we will be this year going up to Paso and that area as well.
Much needed. Thank
much
you.
Needed. And we also work with a lot of vet clinic partners. We can't do everything in our mobile units. We get a lot of requests for help with emergency pet care, for example, or just urgent care in general. And we try to help so that those pets don't suffer. When a pet suffers in the family, the whole family suffers. So we want to avoid that. So we have funding that we called Albus Fund is one of the funds that we're pulling from that can pitch in some money towards those urgent appointments. And we love our vet clinic partners. We couldn't do what we do without them. That's kind of our biggest, the medical program is the biggest. And then we have a Safe Haven program. We started Safe Haven in 2022 to help survivors of domestic violence. A lot of times people won't leave an abusive situation because of a pet. And we wanted to make sure that people can get away and not have to worry about their pets or leave them behind. So we take them in to boarding or foster. And that's been really, it's a heartbreaking and heartwarming program at the same time, but much needed. We have a companion pet assistance program that helps with things like pet food, supplies, grooming for the unhoused, pets of the unhoused. We do a lot of different things through this program. We distribute a lot of pet food through pet resource centers and also community events. And we're hoping to have more pet resource centers established in Slo County as we are working more and more in this community here. When we started Care for Paws, it was mainly for Santa Barbara County, but we've grown and now we have our mobile clinic program here. For example, we have a pet resource center set up at Five Cities Homeless Coalition. We just partnered up with the city of Slo to provide more resources for the unhoused. Mm-hmm. So different programs like that, again, looking at building safety net services.
Yeah. I know I refer a lot of people to you guys, but I want you to explain, like, who can access your services? Is there an income level, anything like that, that people should know about?
Yeah, that's a great question. So our focus demographics are low-income, senior, disabled, and unhoused community members mainly. Every time we run our mobile clinics, we have a walk-in component where we do basics like vaccines, flea treatment, dewormer, nail trims, and microchips for a very low cost. It's also great time for us to connect with pet families in need and set them up for a spay or neuter or mass removal or other vet care that that family might have, and they when they can't afford going to a vet. And at that point, for our spay neuter program doesn't really have an income qualifier, but we do ask some questions about a financial need. Mm-hmm. On the vet care side, we obviously don't want to take away business from vet clinic partners or any vet clinic in the community. So we do ask for income verification for that program specifically. And then our fees are very, very low cost. But if someone cannot afford to pay anything, we comp. We comp a lot of services, really thousands and thousands of dollars worth of services every year.
Do you have your clinics weekly or a few a month, or does it depend?
We operate 4 to 5 days per week, but we have regular locations in Santa Barbara County that we go to, basically Tuesdays and Wednesdays. And a lot of times we're up here on Thursdays or every other Thursday. We do first Sunday of the month, we're in Oceano, and that's in a partnership with PetSmart Charities. We got a grant for 4 years, which is just so incredibly generous. And that's all about access to care. Everything that Care for Paws does is really about access to care. But this grant is actually called that. And Oceano does not have a vet clinic. They don't, they really have no resources locally, and the poverty rate is quite high. So we go there once a month and help not just Oceano residents, but they get services for free. But then it's open to all of Slo County or Santa Barbara County for that also. And so it's a great day for people to come because most people don't work on Sundays. Mm. And so usually we help about 150 pets on those Sundays in Oceano.
That's awesome. And I do want to clarify, do you mostly just see cats and dogs, or do you see other critters as well?
Mainly cats and
dogs.
Okay,
I just want to make sure.
We do get inquiries about bunnies, anything from bunnies to birds to, gosh, they're reptiles. But, and we never really, it's not like we could maybe help them in our mobile clinic, but we don't. If you have questions, you can call us. We we never turn anybody away just with a, no, we don't do that. We always try to provide a resource.
Figure something out. Yeah. Okay. Of course, I know being a nonprofit, you can't do this work without the generous donations from the community. Tell us the ways that people can help.
Donations, always amazing, of course. Foster care is so much demand for it right now, but also a lot of unhoused are going through transitions. People go through rehab or temporary hospitalization. So we can take those pets in as long as we have a foster placement or a low-cost boarding opportunity. And those pets get reunited with their families when the time is right. And I know we're going to talk about the LA fires and rescue efforts later, but that's another reason why we're looking for fosters right now for some adoptable dogs that we took in.
Do you look for things like, you know, pet food, blankets, towels, anything like that people can help out with, and where could they donate those?
Oh, absolutely. Pet food, we distribute so much every week around the Central Coast. Blankets, towels, we can use a lot of towels in our mobile units. If people visit our website, which is careforpaws.org with the number 4, You can find our clinic schedule there, and you can always drop things off with our mobile clinic. That might be the easiest way.
Okay.
But we also have volunteers that can come pick things up, and we will work with you if to get those donations.
Okay. So do you use volunteers at your clinics as well?
We do, okay. And they are amazing. We could not do our clinics. And since we cover two counties, we have different volunteers in different cities.
Little teams,
they really help us make all that doable.
How can people make a monetary donation?
Yeah, our website has... I think it has donate buttons everywhere.
I hope so.
And there are different ways to give. You can restrict to a certain program. Obviously, the ones that are unrestricted for where it's needed most. You can choose to sponsor a spay neuter or dog training or someone's microchip or vaccine or our youth program.
And then being a big events person at Woods, do you do some annual events that the community could be a part of and help out?
Yeah, we actually have our big annual Happy Tales celebration and fundraiser coming up in Santa Barbara at the Cabrillo Pavilion on May 4th. It's a Sunday, and the event is from 3 to 7 p.m. We really call it Happy Tales, with as in the wagging tail, because we share stories about... They share what kind of services we provided and how it's really assisted their families and a lot of times saving lives, preventing suffering. And so it's so much fun collecting those stories and hearing what people have to say.
And that's May 4th. So I'm assuming tickets aren't on sale yet, but they are. Ooh, you guys are on it.
We're on it. Yes, because this is our big gig. Now we're looking for sponsorships. Obviously, you can buy tickets and everything is on our website. And also... Donations of silent and live auction packages are much appreciated.
And, of course, we're going to chat with Katie. You are a brand new owner at Creekside. Tell me how that is going and about some of the projects you're working on right now.
Yeah, definitely. As you mentioned earlier, I've been in the vet field for about 15 years. I started as a volunteer at a shelter as well, actually down at the Agora Animal Shelter, and got my first dog there. And then I worked in vet clinics. I've worked for Patterson Vet Supply, which is a distribution company for veterinarians, for about 9 years. And my family was looking for something to invest in and wanted to get into a business. And we came across Creekside for sale, and it just felt like the right fit. It's in the industry that I know and love. It's on a beautiful 5 acres. So my two boys, they're 2 and 4, have been loving running around it and playing with their new chickens and just hanging out. But we're really excited. We've already made some changes. We took over the Friday before Thanksgiving. And so it hasn't been about not even quite 2 months yet, but we've added a bunch more yards with covers. So now we are open for daycare on rain days as well. So our dogs have lots more room to play when it's raining. We've added some more cat kennels so that we have more places for our kitties. We've added some cat trees in our suites. Next, I would like to add patios so our cats can go have some outside time as well. And then we're also looking to add some programs soon to our dogs, as including an enrichment program for daycare. So we're really excited for the outcome. And then in addition to that, we're looking at a lot of our partnerships of our community and kind of how to connect with more of our community, because that's really important to me and my husband as well.
If you are just joining us, you're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Robin with Woods Humane Society, and my guest today on Peace, Love, and Pets is Isabel, Executive Director of Care for Paws, and Katie, new owner of Creekside Pet Boarding. So I've loved some of the kitty content, because we have a lot of doggy daycares. We get a lot of questions at Woods about that. So, like, what's kind of the setup for those cats?
Yeah, definitely. So the previous owners did have the cattery. We've also, as I mentioned, added additional kennels in our cattery. So our cattery is a separate standalone building. It's actually a two-bedroom house. We have 4 different options for kitties, depending on what they need, anywhere from our kitty kennels, kitty condos, kitty suites, and then we have a big kitty room. Kitties stay with their own family cats. We don't socialize cats with other family cats. So the big kitty room is for up to 3 cats that are from the same family. Our suites can hold up to 2 cats from the same family, or maybe more active kitties that want to run around. And then our condos and our kennels are for cats that are happier just kind of hanging out in their little hiding box. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they all have, we use feel away pheromone to keep them de-stressed in the area. They are separate from the dogs. We have a sound machine going for them in our suites. And in our big kitty room, we have cat trees for them to climb. So lots of options there. And then we do offer one-on-one times with our kitties as well so that they aren't just sitting in a kennel all day. They are getting some love and attention from our staff as well.
I love that. Do you guys accommodate dogs that aren't as comfortable around other dogs?
Yeah, I'm actually really glad you brought that up because I think you're right. A lot of people assume doggy daycare is just for the social dogs.
Right.
But we have 30 different play yards. So we do have them of different sizes. We have our larger yards that are for our social dogs, but we do have 10 yards that are smaller for either solitary dogs that are single or solitary families if you maybe have two dogs that want to stay together. And so for us, every dog that comes in is looked at by our trainer first so that she can kind of see how they interact both with humans as well as with other dogs. And if the owner is open to them being socialized, we will attempt to socialize. If they're not social or the owner doesn't want them to be social, we do have play yards for them to hang out on their own.
And I know you guys have recently partnered on something, and I hear you guys are kind of in works to build some spaces to be able to help almost like foster some of these more difficult situations. Well, how did that start and what made you want to get involved in that?
So we are working with Care for Paws on the Pet Refuge Project. The goal of the project is basically we have 7 unused kennels that are currently storage. We'd like to convert them back into use with their own private little indoor-outdoor yards and an additional play yard specifically to foster some of the animals that come through Care for Paws for the unhoused population, domestic violence cases, etc., so that they have a safe place to always put those pets. With Care for Paws, they reached out to us about a similar situation as this with Mama Dog and her 10 3-day-old puppies that needed somewhere to go and be temporarily placed. And we worked together to bring them in and fostered them. And we're actually still trying to adopt them out. 7 of the puppies have found homes.
Okay.
2 of them found homes in my house.
Oh.
And there are 3 that still need adoption. So anyone that needs to adopt. Isabel, I don't know if you wanted to share a little bit on your side.
Well, yeah, we're so grateful that we have partnered with you. And so this mama dog, Diamond, is owned by someone going through, she's been unhoused for a long time, and now she's going through temporary transition through Good Sam Shelters. And of course, she couldn't stay there with the mama and the 10 puppies. So we took them in, and like Katie mentioned, they're 7 out of the 3 have been adopted. So we're still looking for 3 more homes for these cute, cute puppies. And it's just been a godsend because we didn't know where to send this puppy, and we wanted to keep them with the mom, and we also wanted to have the opportunity to spay and neuter and vaccinate and make sure that they go into the community healthy and altered to not have more of these litters coming our way. So, like I said, a godsend to have that partnership. And from there, we started looking at ways to help more families in this situation, and these kennels will be super helpful for us to be able to just call on short notice and say that we have someone that really needs our help right now. Because finding the fosters, as you know, can be tough. This will really open up the doors for us to be able to help more people going through that temporary transition.
Where can people find more information about Creekside?
Creekside is at www.creeksidepetboarding.com, or we're also on Instagram and Facebook, creekside.pet.boarding. And then we are looking as well for the Pet Refuge Project, any monetary donations, as well as if anybody is a contractor, fencing company, etc., and can donate time or materials, labor, you can reach out to either us or to Care for Paws for that.
Great. Yeah, awesome. The Pet Project is listed on our website as well, and that's CARE4PAWS.org. We're also on socials. It's just /CareForPaws on Facebook, and then CareForPaws SB is our Instagram tag, and then we're on LinkedIn as well. Yeah, and there are naming opportunities for those kennels, for a big play yard we hope to build. And Care for Paws also have opportunities for mobile clinic sponsorships where you can have your name or business logo on the back of both of our units that travel up and down the Central Coast.
Awesome. Well, that's a great opportunity for someone traveling all over the counties, Santa Barbara and San Luis.
Good visibility.
Yes. Well, thank you, ladies, for what you're doing and for being part of the community and helping so many people and pets. And as I wrap up, I do want to share, of course, the topic is on all of our minds. We have all pitched in and helped with what we can do for the LA fires and animals in that situation. Katie took items down to help out. You went down and brought some animals back, I believe, with Care for Paws as well. And then Woods has done 2 van fulls of animals back to our community. And I did want to clarify, we are only bringing animals that were already in the shelters, that were already waiting to be adopted. These are not animals that will now not be able to be reunited with their families. So if you are looking for ways to help right now, sharing those adoptable pets is the best way that we can help. I would be remiss if I do not remind people, please make a plan now. Make friends with your neighbors. Everybody should have a plan, a person. If you are 45 minutes away from your home and they are evacuating, who can get your dog? Who can get your cat? So let's be prepared and keep those pets safe. You can always find out more at woodshumane.org. And please don't forget, your new best friend is waiting for you at the shelter.
This is KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. Up next, Playing with Food with Father Ian.
So there's a point at which something happens today, right?
No.
Or is it just 3 hours of drinking?
Tasting.
Well, tasting.
Okay, there's a dinner, there's food, and yeah, there is food.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll have you eating.
Okay.
Get going. You're hearing the sounds of the Garagiste Festival in Atascadero. What is a Garagiste Festival? It's a wine festival. What's unique about this particular wine festival? It's celebrating wines from wineries that produce fewer than 1,500 cases annually. That's what makes them Garagiste. We'll get a better understanding of that term in a minute, but let's have a quick sip with a vintner surrounded by the joyous sounds of the festival before getting a taste of what Garagiste really is.
I'm Taylor Matheson. I'm a winemaker. I've got Cutbow Wines. I also help make wine at Levo Vineyard in Tin City.
Your bottles have Avery labels on them. Can you tell me why?
These are just barrel samples, so I haven't created any labels for these. I'm a big outdoors guy. I grew up hunting and fishing. I'm a steward of the land. Nature is one of the best things in the entire world that was put on this earth and that we can go and appreciate it. We've got feathers on one label, fly fishing reel on another label, and that's kind of our deal.
So how long have you been doing this?
Cutbow started in 2022. That was our first vintage. We bottled that just this last summer, so summer of 2024.
Tell me about the Syrah.
2023 Syrah from Jack Creek Vineyards, Willow Creek, AVA. It's like the most westerly site in Willow Creek, so it's got some pretty cool climate characteristics. 30% stem inclusion in this. Wanted to get some spiciness, you know, that black pepper, a little bit of meaty, almost like reduction, but super fruit driven as well. Fun site to work with, good family friends, the owners out there as well. They kind of gave us a shot of making wine and buying some fruit from them. We did 3 barrels, all once used oak, kind of in between a neutral and a brand new barrel.
Taylor and his Cutbow Winery is a perfect example of the Garagiste category of winemaking. Small, specific, passionate. On my podcast site, you can see a photo of Taylor with a bottle with one of his real labels rather than one with the Avery mailing labels. We'll come back to the festival in a couple minutes, but let's have a chat with the festival's founders and discover the world of Garagiste wines.
I'm Stuart McLennan, one of the co-founders and current president of Garagiste Festival.
And I'm Doug Minnick, Stuart's partner in co-founding the Garagiste Festival.
What is this festival and where does the name come from?
The term Garagiste, I came across, I was doing some research, and Robert Parker had taken a trip to Bordeaux. He went to this chateau, and the people in the chateau said, "Where are you going next?" He said, "I'm going to this winery." And they were like, "Oh, no, they're Garagistes. You don't, no, you know, garbage." Well, it turns out a lot of those wineries became left bank wineries, a whole movement there. And they were just winemakers who didn't have a chateau, didn't come from the manor born and still wanted to make wine and were skilled winemakers. And because France is France, thought, well, that's an interesting word. You know, that kind of fits. So I pitched it to Doug and Doug goes, "Well, what's it mean, man?" I said to some people who were winemakers, you know, we're doing this thing, Garagiste Festival. I don't know. What is that? Garagiste. I don't know whether I want to be called a Garagiste. Cut to a couple of years later, we've had a couple of festivals now. New York Times is doing an article on Garagiste wineries. They suddenly want to become a Garagiste. Yeah. They're happy to be called a Garagiste. You know, we get an inquiry. Hey, you know, I'm thinking of opening this wine bar and calling Garagiste Wine Bar. And so this wood, whilst it existed in France and was used in France, it was never really existing in California. For the most part, American winemaking. We've been very careful to make it a definition that when people use it, it doesn't necessarily invoke the garage, it invokes small handcrafted, small production, intensely handworked artisan wines. It's kind of the antithesis, actually, of, I'm making a carboy in the garage. This is kind of the next level of that. Although, no snobs. We don't want it to be a snobby thing. These people know a lot about wine, but very few of them will get in front of you and go, oh, but we kind of frown on that.
You're listening to KCBX Public Radio. I'm Father Ian, and I'm at the Garagiste Wine Festival in Atascadero. We just heard founders Doug and Stuart describe Garagiste as small producers under 1,500 cases annually, but why a festival?
So when did you co-found this and why?
In 2011, and because we felt there was a need, particularly in this area originally, to support some of the smaller men and women who are making wine. A lot of them don't have tasting rooms, so they don't have the volume to be able to afford a tasting room, or they're on their way up. So we said they needed a venue, and we started, and it's grown exponentially as a result.
These were our friends. These were the wines that we drank, and we knew how good the wines were. But when you're just a small mom-and-pop operation, you feel like you're kind of working all by yourself, kind of in isolation. And Stuart knew a lot of these small winemakers and wanted to give it a center, give the movement a center and a name, and shine a spotlight on these kinds of winemakers and bring them all together. So we decided to try a festival, an event, to bring them all together. And one day, we didn't know what we had. We knew at least we'd have one day of drinking some really good wine, which we did.
That was a success. First one was like, okay, that's good. We should do this again.
It was very, very popular. Then the winemakers in Santa Barbara asked us to bring it down there, so we did that. Now, 14 years later, we do this Paso event, which is the flagship event every year. This is our 13th one in our 14th year. Thank you, COVID. We also now do them in Solvang for the San Ynez wineries, Sonoma for the wineries up there, and one in Los Angeles, which is kind of for all of the wineries.
When you first started in 2011 and you had a great night of drinking wine, how many wineries were there and how many tasters were there?
I'm going to say it was like 300 or 400, and we had what?
40 wineries.
40 wineries, yeah. When we first started out.
In these 14 years, have you seen any of these small wineries blossom?
Oh, absolutely. So we have some wineries that are small and have been small and are going to stay small. And then we have a lot of new wineries that sort of launch with us. If anyone's ever been to Tin City between Templeton and Paso, about 80% of the tasting rooms in Tin City are wineries that started pouring at the Garagiste Festival before they had a tasting room. So Tin City is almost like kind of the year-round manifestation of the Garagiste Festival.
Not everyone wants to grow. Some people are very happy to remain small, very boutique-y. Others have aspirations to grow into a larger winery. We've seen that happen in many that have started with us and who are now sort of established brands. Carl Balker at Caliza, started pouring with us. Off the top of my head, I can't tell you how many, but quite a few. But it's not necessarily a thing that everyone wants to grow out of this, because there's a lot of pain comes with growth, as you well know. In the wine business, there are various cutoffs along the way. If you're going to get to X thousand cases, well, that means you have to have distribution. Then that means you have a sales force. That means you have a national sales force, and so on and so on and so on. And you get further away from actually making wine. The other thing about our festival, 9 times out of 10, like even tonight, you will find the winemaker behind the table. And we've made a point of trying to put as many winemakers in front of our audience as possible. So when we say to people, if you want a table at our festival, we expect you to show up. So you're not having a conversation like you would have had with me when I was doing national sales and I was at Pebble Beach or whatever representing the winery. You're actually talking to the winemaker. You're talking about their aims, their ambitions, what they want to do, why they like this variety.
One of the things about wineries of this size is because we're so small, we don't make enough wine for a distributor to be interested. So there's freedom in that. We also don't have to make what distributors want. They want wines to put on supermarket shelves or in restaurants. They want Cabernet and Pinot and Chardonnay, which is fine. We have plenty of that. But because most of these winemakers sell direct to consumer, you're able to pursue your real passions of maybe unusual varieties or styles that you won't find anywhere else. I think this is getting close to the 40th event we've done over the past 14 years, and I am still finding grape varieties I've never even heard of because somebody fell in love. I fell in love with this variety in Greece, and then I found a farmer who's got 2 acres of it, and they make 3 barrels of it, and here it is, and they're super passionate about it, and it's excellent. But you can get away with that. You can make that work, making 3 or 4 barrels or something because you're selling it direct to consumer. You can never make it work on a larger scale.
You know, when you're in a larger market, you can't sell 5 million varieties. But here, I mean, you can come tomorrow and tonight, you'll probably taste maybe 30 different varieties of wine. Then there'll be trends that'll come out of that. I've noticed a lot more people making Tempranillo now. Some of the Spanish varieties are coming to be made more. Then there's Italian varieties. People are making Sangio. They're making Barberas. You know, they're doing the big Tuscan blends. They're doing all these things that were boutique-y or very small market. And our festival gives them exposure. The quality of these wines is top-notch. You know, a few years ago, I was just amazed at the consistency of quality and how that's just now. It's like at a plane where you would rarely go in there and go, the wines are always well-made. They're cared for, and these people love them like they're their little babies. For me, this is like doing the best with what you have that year and as little intervention as possible. And that, to me, always bespeaks a really good wine.
Stuart mentioned that Garagiste winemakers sometimes like to experiment with lesser-known grape varietals, so I sought some of those out.
Malvasia Bianca is a white grape from Greece, Italy, Portugal. It's only grown in a few places, and it's very unique flavor. I get mine from Madeira in the valley. I've been hunting them down because I want to get some more of those grapes.
Carmenere is a grape varietal. It's known as the lost grape of Bordeaux. Thought to be extinct, and then they found it in South America, was able to bring it back to California through a Davis study. And I think in 1990s is when they were able to provide it to winemakers in California.
Felicidade is Portuguese for joy, bliss, and happiness, but the grape is called Arinto. There's only about 20 acres planted in the entire U.S. The U.S. government doesn't recognize it as an official grape name, and that's why I had to give it a fanciful name. And it's such a bright and happy wine, I thought that word fit it perfectly. Those grapes are grown at Pierce Ranch Vineyard in southern Monterey County. They specialize in growing Portuguese and Spanish varieties.
And the following day, at the bigger event in Paso Robles, I sought out some vintners who are doing the best with what they have.
I'm Fio DeRodiff, and I'm the proprietor and winemaker at Rockbound Cellars.
My name is Cece Aguirre, and I'm the owner and winemaker of Loom.
How long have you been making wine?
For about 4 years now. This is my fourth harvest.
Since 2017, so 8 years.
Both of you are fairly new at making wine. How's the journey been?
Amazing. I've loved winemaking from the very beginning, and it's still my full-time day job, and it just turned into a passion project starting in 2021. We just love what we do so much that we do it in our free time.
So you have another job?
I do. I work full-time at a winery already, so this is my before and my after work and my weekend job.
For me, it's been a crazy experience because my previous career was actually working at the NASA Center in Mountain View, and I did that for 15 years. I was more in like the finance and contracts area, and then I completely changed my career and planted our vineyard and started making wine with our consultant winemaker, Molly Lomborg. And she's been an amazing mentor, and it's been a real, very rewarding journey for me to try something completely new that I had no experience with. And the more I do it, the more I love it. And it's just been a great, great, great time so far. So we're looking forward to sharing our wines with everyone. We just released our inaugural vintage at Rockbound, so we're excited to pour it here at Garagiste.
For both of you, this is your first time at this festival. It's only been, what, an hour and a half?
This has been such a pleasure because not only is it our first ever pouring at Garagiste, it's our first time sharing our wines completely. We've never even poured at an event in general. You know, we just became legal a few months. This is our first, you know, exposure and getting to see people face to face and the reception to our wines. And it's just been very rewarding already.
How's the reception been?
Great. Better than I expected. It's a big confidence booster to do something you love. And like I said, we started in 2021. So this has been a long time coming to finally be able to share these wines and get some reactions and just make it all worthwhile.
It's been really great, like getting all the feedback from people trying our wines for the first time ever. And also just kind of networking with other producers that are our size, that are small, that are doing all the work themselves, that have just put in a lot of work to be here. And this is an outlet that we don't get anywhere else. And so people that come here to this event know that, and they appreciate the wine and the process, and they really take their time to kind of taste through and understand the owners and the winemakers and the people behind the table. And I think it's all part of that experience, and Garagiste, I think, really brings that to life.
You see some friends here?
Yeah, I do, because the community here in Paso is really amazing. Like, you end up meeting a lot of other producers that are on kind of in the same boat that you are, and we all help each other out. We've borrowed things from each other. We talk to each other. We're not afraid to really have this network of helping hands. And I've reached out to people that I don't even know before, and they are willing to help, to lend a hand, whether it's when winemaking or when we have tasting events. I see people that have helped me throughout this crazy journey just here in this room.
This group in particular is just very special, like-minded individuals. And most people, I think, would agree this is our passion project. We hope it becomes something that is beyond that and not just a hobby and something worthwhile. I love seeing all the referrals left and right, like so-and-so table sent you to us and vice versa. It's just the camaraderie and the community within this room is really special.
What's one thing that has surprised you today?
I think one thing that surprised me the most is how serious the customers take the wine. We just started doing this maybe a year ago. A lot of the other festivals seems like people are just there to like drink. But here people come, they have a notebook and they're taking notes and they really look for people like us, new producers, and they want to try new things. And we want to share our wines with people that appreciate the wines like that. So I think that was something that so far I've taken from this event. People are very honest of what they think about wine is another surprise, I guess. So far, we've had really positive feedback, and it's just very reassuring that we're doing the right thing, that we're on the right track, and that we're going to keep doing what we're doing for everyone to enjoy. So that's been great.
I think I'll second that. I am really impressed by this group of individuals that seek out an event like this, and they're looking for those producers that are just getting their feet off the ground or that are small and maybe want to stay small. They're an educated customer and group of people interested in not only what you made, but why you made it and what your brand is and how can they find you. And it's just the ideal group to be pouring for when people are that excited to discover you.
Last night I was talking to Stuart and Doug, who are the founders, and they told me that no snobs allowed. Is it really a no snobs allowed event in your experience?
Oh, definitely. I think it's more of an interest and an educated customer without them trying to tell us how to do our jobs. Just a very educated customer who's excited to learn everything about your story and your startup and the wines that you're making.
Yeah, and it looks like most of the attendees here, they're just genuinely interested in learning about the wines and tasting through the wines and learning about us as people as well. I haven't ran into any snobs at all. I think everybody's got a smile on their face and they just want to try good wine, and that's pretty much like all it is.
You're listening to KCBX Public Radio. I'm Father Ian, and I'm at the Garagiste Wine Festival in Paso Robles. I got the opportunity to talk with Gary Eberle, who came to the Paso Robles wine region in 1972 when there were 3 wineries and 200 acres of grapes. Though he's not a Garagiste winemaker, he has had an outsized influence on the wine industry in North San Luis Obispo County. He had a few bits of advice for the new winemakers. What does the festival mean to you?
I think it's a great way for people that have a passion for wine to get into our business and see if they are really destined to stay in it. This is a hard industry. With rare exception, unless you win the lottery, it takes about 10 years for a winery to actually start breaking even and making money. And you have to have the passion and some sort of income, a wife working or a teacher or something, to be able to keep it up. Typically, if you can stay in the business 8-10 years and get over the point people are starting to recognize your label and the quality of your wine, that you can become successful. I started my winery in 83, and it was 1991 before I broke even. To get a label established and build up a clientele and a reputation that will propel you off into the future, you need to be able to think about at least 8 years of feeding it and living off of something else. It takes sort of a special mindset or whatever to recognize that this isn't an industry, it's not a job, it's a lifestyle.
At the Garagiste Wine Festival, I saw quite a few younger people who were making wine, really eager and enthusiastic, are probably learning firsthand some of the things that you said about you've got to be basically married to this for at least a decade before it starts becoming lucrative. Any advice you have for the budding new Garagiste winemaker?
Make sure it's what you really want to do. Don't look at it as just something that looks like it might be fun. Look at it that it is. I mean, if you want to be successful, you had better be absolutely in love with this business. You better be extrovert and you better like people. Of course, you better know how to make good wine, too.
The Garagiste Festival certainly lives up to its original intention, with almost a winery a day in each of Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo counties, and just under 2 wineries a weekend in Monterey County. The Central Coast needs a venue to discover the less showy wines all in one place. And one winemaker said it the best.
The festival's really great. You know, they really gave a platform for smaller wineries to be showcased and for people to get to find them, because I have a tasting room, but probably half of the wineries and winemakers involved in Garage East don't. So it's really important way to bring everybody together. It's also just a wonderful group of people. It's a lot of good camaraderie, a lot of really nice people that are on the winemaking side. And also it just draws a really great crowd. I really look forward to the tastings. Always good people.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm Playing with Food.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Meher Ali. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments at kcbx.org.